On this episode of Risk, you'll hear...
Fuck you. Knocks the basket over. Fuck you, fuck everybody, and fuck this store.
And you'll hear...
She was driving to church, eating a bowl of cereal, on mountain roads, and drove her ass off of the mountain.
And of course, me, Kevin Allison, on the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. Hello, folks. This episode is called Catastrophe, but it's about people who faced overwhelming situations in such a way that they grew from it and that they're grateful for it. It's one of those things that I most treasure about this show, that we have so many stories that I personally feel reassured by because it's so... easy for me to get into my own head about how bad things are or about how bad things might be tomorrow or next month or whatnot. And then I hear people share stories on this show about getting through so many different big and small things. I'm just constantly adjusting my perspective. Now, before we jump in, musicians, do you want us to play your music on Risk? I'll get to this later in the episode, but everything you need to know is at risk-show.com/music. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear a story by Joel Gonzalez, but to start things off, a story by Emma Yarbrough that was recorded at a Risk live show we did at Aisle 5 in Atlanta last year. I should warn you, there's a violent death recounted in this story. Here is Emma Yarbrough now. It's a story we call Searching for Blue Sky.
I'm asleep in my bed when suddenly I'm jolted awake. I hold my breath and try to listen over the pounding of my heart, and I hear it again. Someone's broken into my house. I immediately go through all of my options, and I decide the best thing that I can do is build a barricade at my bedroom door. So I jump out of bed, I have a sofa in my bedroom, I push it up against the wall, and then I just start loading the heaviest things I can get on top of the sofa so that it will take a while for someone to bust through the door and I'll have enough time to dial 911. As I hear footsteps coming down the hall, I start dialing. And just before I'm about to press send, I hear Emma. And just like that, I snap back into myself. And I understand that that's my roommate. She's come home unexpectedly. And I am once again in a PTSD-induced panic attack. At this point, I haven't had PTSD for very long. It's only been a few months because a few months prior to this, I am sitting on my couch. I remember I'm reading a book. And I get a text from my mom. And it says, "Your Aunt Day's house burnt down last night." And it doesn't hit me immediately that I have lost my favorite place in the world. My Aunt Day's house is my refuge. It's my sanctuary. As a child, I was very sensitive. I was really shy. I was pretty awkward. And going to Aunt Day's house was like the only opportunity I had to really feel like I belonged. And it was so special to belong there because it was magic at Aunt Day's house. Her house is a cabin up in the western North Carolina mountains. And in order to get to that cabin, you had to drive up this driveway that was like a 45-degree angle. And driving up that driveway literally felt like you were passing through a veil into this magical fairyland that my Aunt Day had created. There's a babbling mountain brook that's ice cold where you can mine for gemstones, rose quartz, garnets, rubies if you're lucky. And the wildlife there is incredible. It's actually a rainforest there, so the wildflowers and the biodiversity is just mind-boggling. And not only that, when I'm up at my Aunt Day's house, I'm also with my Aunt Day, who is my absolute favorite person in the world. She's the funniest person I know, which is really astonishing that she is so funny and has this incredible outlook on life, this deep appreciation for the beauty of nature, for living in the moment, because she's had such a hard life. Time and time again, disasters befall this woman. If anything crazy is going to happen, it's going to happen to her. For instance, she survived an RV camper explosion that lit her nightgown on fire and gave her third-degree burns. One time, she was driving to church, eating a bowl of cereal, which is not advised, on mountain roads and drove her ass off of the mountain. Once, she was on a cross-country road trip. Sorry, not a road trip. She was in a train. I guess that's a road trip. No, it's a track trip. She was on a cross-country track trip, and she was almost stabbed by someone. And then, a little ways down the track, that train hit another train. Like, this one trip, y'all, this shit only happened to her. And the thing about it is, she was an incredible storyteller, and she would recount these insane hijinks and pickles that she got herself into and have you laughing with tears. Like, I can still hear her just, y'all, it was terrible, you know? So even though it's devastating that this house is gone, I know that in some time, Aunt Day is going to have a hilarious story to tell about her house burning down. About an hour after I got the text from my mom, my phone rings, and it's her again. And she says, "Sweetie, they found Aunt Day's body in the house. And we need to prepare ourselves because they think someone committed a crime. And the first thing out of my mouth is, I don't want to think about that. Just immediately, no." And she says, "I know, but we have to." When I get off the phone, I literally spin in place. I circle myself because I don't know where I can move forward, because all I want to do is move in the direction where I'm rewinding time, where murder is just a word. It's a plot point in a movie. It is not my reality, and it is not something that's happened to my favorite person in the world. So the PTSD is with me all the time. And I'm grateful in some ways because it's protecting me. It's protecting my brain. I know that what happened was a 19-year-old kid was arrested on drug charges and awaiting trial and escaped jail and made his way to a mountain cabin where he knew a widow lived alone, and maybe he could steal her car, and maybe he could get a gun. And so he made his way there, and he killed her, and he burnt the house to the ground to cover his tracks. And he's caught immediately, and now is in prison for the rest of his life. And I feel like I am in a prison of my mind for the rest of my life. because the PTSD is constant. Every night when I dream, it's a nightmare, and it's a nightmare that there is some intense violence either being enacted on me or on someone I love. Every flight is going to crash. Every time I'm in a movie theater, there's going to be a shooting. At a gay pride parade, I think I see a sniper on top of a building and I run. On the 4th of July, we're shooting fireworks in the roads and a big black SUV comes slowly down the road and I'm immediately positive that there's going to be a drive-by shooting and I book it. But then there's this other thing that keeps happening. I am so deeply depressed and so full of sorrow. I'm at times in places deeper than I thought I would ever be able to go emotionally. But on the other hand, when I laugh, I'm laughing harder than I've ever laughed. And when I see a movie or listen to a piece of music or read something that moves me, it is so achingly beautiful, I can't take it. I start to imagine my traumatic grief as a rubber band. And even though I am being pulled as deep as I can get, there is this counteraction that is allowing me to reach heights of joy and appreciation for beauty that I've never experienced before. And that makes me think of my Aunt Day and the story she told about the catastrophes in her life. At her memorial service, it wasn't a regular funeral because we didn't have her body, it was with the police. So instead, we all just got together and told stories about her. And I heard this story that I'd never heard before from her best friend. Just a few weeks before she died, her best friend had decided to drive to the cabin to visit her and see how she was doing. And as she was driving down that road, getting closer to that 45-degree angle driveway, she saw that there was something in the ditch. And then as she got even closer, she realized it was Day in the ditch. So she stopped her car and pulled over and came out and was like, Day, are you okay? Do you need any help? And my Aunt Day said, yeah, you know, I'm fine. I was coming down the driveway to check my mail and I tripped and I fell over and I couldn't get up. But you know what? Look at this sky. Look at these clouds. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful? So, I don't have my Aunt Day anymore, and I don't have my sanctuary, but I laugh through tears all the time. And in that way, my Aunt Day is closer to me than ever before. Thank you.
We'll be right back. Folks, this episode of Risk is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, I know so many friends who struggle because they feel like other people have it all figured out as far as romance or their sex lives go, or have it all together, or got it all. Then I know so many other people who are deep in relationships and really feel like some problems in their relationships are intractable. So in February, you know, when it's Valentine's season, a lot of people get a little down in the dumps or a little anxious about all the roses and candies and flowers and whatnot. But the truth is, everyone, me more than anyone maybe, is still learning, is still kind of figuring it out as we go. And therapy is a great way to work on that. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can really lay out your therapy goals. And if you find that you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So, sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/risk. That's betterhelp.com/risk.
The Philly cheesesteak is back at McDonald's and it's still intensely cheesy. Imagine the cheesiest thing ever. Now cover it in cheese, add two beef patties, cheddar cheese sauce, crispy onions, and even more cheese. The Philly cheesesteak. Did we mention it's cheesy? Available until the 16th of March 2026 from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
There once was a woman who lived in a shoe. A size too snug, but what could she do? But that's not where her story ends. Thanks to a little help from her Experian friends, she got her score into much better shape and relocated to a box-fresh new place with room to grow and a mortgage to suit. Now, she lives in a spacious four-bedroom cowboy boot. Better your Experian credit score to help get mortgage ready. Experian. Better your score. Better your story.
We're back.
This is Risk. This is Django behind me now, and we just heard from Emma Yarborough. That moment of Emma's Aunt Day enjoying the beauty of the blue sky from the ditch she had fallen into is one I think I'll remember forever. Emma has a solo show she'll be doing in many cities this summer. It's named after her aunt. It's called Day. Emma's a senior producer with one of our very favorite storytelling organizations and podcasts, The Story Collider. And you can learn where Emma's doing her solo show, Day, at emmayarborough.com. Now here's something different. An artist and Risk fan named Matt Elzhwag wrote to me offering to do an illustration or two inspired by a couple of our stories. He illustrated two stories from our Come and Go episode from a couple weeks ago. The drunken burglar story from Ezra Homeland and the sperm bank story from Sarah Adelman. Check it out on our Facebook and Instagram feed at Risk Show and see more of Matt's work at Matt Elzhwag. Now, there's a bonus story that just went out from David Zelnick on our Patreon. And it sounds a little bit like this.
I see this 6'5" blonde guy and I catch his eye and I'm pretty sure he's cruising me and I cruise him back and I'm married, but I always get curious in situations like this. And I'm not even into tall guys, but I will say there's always something exciting about the idea of bringing down big game.
So last week, we just had that conversation story with David Zelnick on the Lights Off, Pants Down episode. And now there's this truly fantastic and very different kind of story from David that is exclusive to our patrons. And there's plenty more where that came from. Plus our Storytelling for Business video course, videos of our live shows, access to the live streams of those live shows going out to anywhere in the world. You can get the ad-free feed of the podcast there. And most importantly, you'd be making it possible for Risk to continue to exist. Not kidding. By joining our Patreon or upping your current support level at patreon.com/risk, or you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me. /risk. Now, next up, that story from Joel Gonzalez. Now, this, this takes us away for just a moment from this difficult era we are in to a very recent other difficult era we were once in. And in a way, it is a reminder that, okay, we did make it through that. This is Joel Gonzalez with a story we call Keeping Us Safe.
So I've worked in retail for most of my adult life. It's not the most glamorous job in the world, but it's decent pay and it's union. And my job's basic, stocking shelves, helping customers, checking out groceries, the usual. But my job forever changed in March of 2020 when COVID first struck. And suddenly, I went from being just a regular retail guy to an essential worker. Now, being an essential worker means that, oh, you have to go to your job no matter what because we need you and your life doesn't matter. That's what felt like being an essential worker. So naturally, I was scared. I had no choice. It was either work, maybe get sick and die, or don't work and starve to death. So what choice did I have? I had to work. Now, I was not only concerned about my safety, I was concerned about my wife's safety as well. We've been married for about a year at this point, together for five. And in December 2019, she started showing early signs of carpal tunnel in her arms. At first, it was small, minor, little pain here and there. Nothing that some aspirin, some braces, or some stretching couldn't help. But then it started to get worse and worse and worse. And it got to the point where she couldn't work anymore. It was up to me to help her with simple activities like opening doors, opening packages, making sure that I was sitting one position in the room so her head wouldn't turn because the carpal tunnel was so severe that it went all the way up to her neck and that she couldn't stand it. She had to sit on the floor to watch shows or movies with me at all. Also, I had to like help her preparing some food here and there because she couldn't do certain things with her arms. So I became somewhat of a caretaker during this time. Also, what was revealed to me during her carpal tunnel issue was my wife was a germaphobe. I didn't know how severe it was at first, really. Honestly, before then, I would know she washed her hands more than once or twice, and I thought nothing about it. I'm like, oh, okay, likes to stay clean. But as this pandemic raged on, and I watched her watching the news, looking at her phone, eyes just white with terror, she started washing more frequently, started hand sanitizing more frequently. Every time I came from work, it was a list of questions of where I was and how I masked up and where I could be. It got worse and worse and worse. She would not leave the house. So I knew at this point it was up to me to make sure that we were both safe and that she would not get sick because she sincerely believed that her immune system was compromised because of her condition. So I did whatever I could to keep us safe. The pressure was on big time. When this pandemic first started and everyone's working at home, retail people, we were first to be forgotten. The lucky ones out there who had the desk jobs and answered emails, they gotta stay at home. They gotta wake up in their PJs and dress from just the top down in front of a Zoom screen. The retail workers, no, we had none of that luxury. We had none of it. We were guinea pigs right when we got out there to see what was gonna happen to us or if society can still survive with the retail workers because everyone needs their food. So every day at work, it felt like I was preparing for a war, preparing for a biohazard war, I guess it's safe to say. I had my clothes in a separate part of the house in like garbage bags to make sure they wouldn't get contaminated to anybody. I would wipe down the bottoms of my shoes, my steel-toe boots with Clorox wipes every day as much as I can get them on. I wore these heavy cargo pants with many pockets, and the pockets were necessary for my job. Necessary to survive, I should say, because I needed backup masks. I needed tons and tons of latex gloves. I needed hand sanitizers. I needed sprays. I need everything on me so I can just go around this world and not get sick. It got to the point where I purchased a UV box ray that I found on Amazon, which you put keys and wallets and phones in there and it blasts safe rays of radiation on all your items. And what I couldn't fit in there, I would just Clorox, like my iPad. You know, who knows what damage it did to it, and who knows what damage it did to my food at the same time. Now, with all this going on, you could tell that I was all about safety. I was all about keeping us both safe. So, when the masking started, you know, it started out like, only nurses, only doctors, don't put on masks. And then it came clear, oh no, we all have to wear masks. And watching the news, doom scrolling on Twitter or whatever, was saying, masks are the key. Masks will give up this pandemic. You put on the mask and we can all be rid of this virus. It's March 2020. Maybe we can all have Christmas together. Maybe we can all be safe. We all just stick to the rules, keep 6 feet distance and mask, and we can kill this virus. And I was like, yes, yes, we can. We can do this. And I have to be that change because I'm on the forefront. I'm out here trying to survive and trying to take care of my wife. And yes, we have to all mask. So, for lack of a better term, I became a mask Nazi. Every time I was out and about, especially at my store, I would go to customers who weren't wearing their masks and go, hey, mask please. No one missed my eye if I was around them. I got to the point where even if they were in the mask incorrectly, as the ones who wore the mask, you know, just not covering their nose, no matter if they had glasses or not, I would say, hey, over the nose, please, over the nose. I would see them and I would pester them. No one was safe from me for putting on a mask. I didn't care what it looked like. I'm like, no. We should all be doing this practice. We should all be doing this together. You should be thanking me that you're putting your mask on right and that I'm telling you what is important information. So you're welcome, everybody. Put your mask on properly. And of course, shaking hands and hugging was strictly out of the question. There is no way. Contact at this point was dead over to me. Even when I ventured out to my own home, maybe months later in the pandemic where I felt safe and had lawn chairs to go outside, my friends would run up to hug me and I would go, whoa, no. Elbow. We put the elbow out. And I was so strict about it. I felt that I was right doing this. I felt my mentality was right because I'll come home. I see my wife still in pain, still crying, still she can't do things. I was having to shop for her. I had to make sure she's okay. I was worried sick every time I had to leave home because I didn't know how she was going to be or how she was going to get around. If I got sick, it's over. It's going to be bad for both of us. And my wife was deathly afraid of this virus. Deathly afraid of it. She had family members in her life who died from cancer and she slowly had to watch them go away. And this was lung cancer, so any sort of respiratory disease really affected her watching the news about it. So, as we go months into this pandemic, I'm still very vigilant. I'm still very much that guy who yelled people for not masking, and I was happy about it, proud to be it. I do remember there was this one incident. There's this male customer, Caucasian, probably mid-50s, long beard, you know, plaid jacket, hat, you know, just leaning over his shopping cart, shopping groceries. I noticed he was on his phone, and his mask fully down under his chin. I saw it. I'm like, sir, hey, yeah, you. Hey, mask up, please. Okay. Grumbled something to me. That was it. I'm like, all right, that's it. I walk around the store. I see him again, mask fully down on his cell phone once again. And I know you can hear anybody through a cell phone on a mask. Trust me, I've done it tons of times. They can hear you. It's not going to disturb your voice. I see him again. Sir, can you please put on your mask? He mutters bullshit to me or something like that and puts the mask on again. And I walk around. Finally, 20 minutes later, towards more the middle of the store, and this is about 5 o'clock, it's pretty busy. There's a lot of people in the store, more than there should be during a pandemic, but that's another story. I see him again. Sir, can you please put your mask on? I am not going to ask you again. And he says, God fucking damn it, man, don't you mind your own goddamn business? I'm like, look here, I've asked you 3 minutes, put on the mask and you have it. I'm talking to my doctor, I have a heart condition. I do not care. If you're really concerned about your health, you put the mask on and stop endangering everybody in the store. At this point, the shouting was getting louder and louder. A crowd started to form around us. And then he started calling me every single curse word you could think of. And I said, like, can you stop acting like a baby and put on your mask for everybody else? He looks at me, stares me down, points his finger at me for some reason quietly, right now, my chest is out, saying, what? What? Do something. And he said, where is your manager? He's right here. And I brought him downstairs. I left the conversation. All I heard was angry noise and angry, this guy should mind his own fucking business, endangering everybody. There was no repercussion, of course, because my manager knew I was right and there was nothing that they really could do in this incident. So, naturally, I'm seeing the news. It's rising. More people are dying. I'm seeing people in different states who pretend the pandemic is not happening at all and spreading the virus to everybody. I'm getting angrier and angrier each day, losing faith in the humanity, losing faith that this virus will ever end. I was slowly, maybe for lack of a better word, losing my mind over this and the stress of my wife, the stress of being at work, the stress that every day I could die. I've seen people who bounced off from COVID. I've had friends who go in the hospital and nearly died. Who knows what was going to happen when I got this? Who knows what's going to happen to my wife? I was worried. So as we get more into 2021, things are easing a bit, but are coming right back. I'm still like, okay, 2021, vaccines are starting to come out, but you know what? It's still very contagious, still very mask up. It was still very much, at the time, safety. There was this one woman who walked into my store. It was also around 5 o'clock as well, on the same day. Busy hour for stores. 5 o'clock's rush hour for a lot of people. This woman, she looked like to be about in her 30s, Caucasian, long brown hair, tan business suit. Kind of attractive, actually. She walks in the store, maskless. I picked up right away. I didn't approach her right away because I think I was busy helping a customer or whatever. But I noticed another employee walked up to her and said, Miss, can you please put on a mask, please? She just walks right by them, grabs a black hand basket, and starts shopping. I remember my employee standing there just puzzled, confused. Like, did she even look at me? Did she even hear what I said? Does she even look around that everyone else is wearing a mask but her? Apparently, this didn't bother her at all. This woman shopped around, and other employees, and including customers, come up to her, Miss, where's your mask? You put a mask on, please? Probably best if you put a mask. She would just look at an item, as if that person wasn't talking, nothing was there, and slowly put items into her little black basket. It's as if she was just walking to a store full of ghosts, and that nothing was affecting her, and that none of us existed. Now, very unlike me, I didn't approach this woman at first. I actually was more fascinated at first of what is she doing. I tried to act like I was working, looking at the aisles, seeing what she was going to doing, as I saw employee after customer walk out to please put on a mask and her ignoring it, shopping, texting on her phone, checking nutrition facts of everything. And as I was looking at this woman, I kept thinking, this is the problem. This is why we're never going to have this pandemic, because of people like her. This is wrong. We're all going to be dead because the world doesn't care. It's people like her who don't care about people's safety and just think they can do whatever they want is why we're all going to die from this virus and why I might die, my wife might die. I started spiraling big time what was going to happen. This person represented everything I hated and everything that was wrong with the world and everything I saw go around the world who was not masking up and letting this virus surge and still take lives and still infect people for years and years to come. I remember towards the end of her shopping, she approached a check stand. She had her black basket and put on the conveyor belt. Now, as a policy, the employees are allowed not to service people who are not practicing protocol. The employee looks at her, looks at her groceries, and says, Miss, can you please put on a mask? She stares at him and stares back at her groceries and notices that the conveyor belt's not moving. The employee asked again, Miss, can you put on your mask, please? I can't check you out if you don't put on a mask. Still staring at her basket, hoping that it'll start moving on its own. It's not moving for her. I can tell she's getting more and more infuriated. Finally, the cashier says, look, miss, if you don't put on a mask and you walk away with those groceries, you will be considered stealing right now. Do you understand me? She finally looks at him, full eye contact, probably the most contact she made of anybody, and just screams the only word she ever said. Fuck you. Knocks the basket over. Fuck you. Fuck everybody. And fuck this store. That was the most words she ever said. She stormed out. People backed away from her, not because only she was maskless, but also she might be unstable as well. This was intense for it to happen. What protest to happen for a rule that everyone's been following and has been okay with for almost a year and a half? I watched this happen. Yeah, also satisfied she didn't get her groceries, but also I was still angry. I was still just very, very angry. I'm like, this, who the fuck she thinks she is? Who the hell she thinks she is? Who is this person thinks she is? I can't fucking believe her. Where is she going? As I was approaching the parking lot to see what car she was going to go in, not that I had any intention of doing anything with her, I wanted to get one last hateful look at this hateful woman, and suddenly I said, Joel, wait a minute. What are you doing? You are about to follow a woman to her car. Oh my God, what am I doing? What have I become? What's happened to me? I was so angry at this woman that I was going to do one of the most fundamental wrong things that any male could do is follow a woman to her car. That's when I kind of knew at that point, like, I've gone too far. Or I had the potential of going too far. I don't think I had any potential of doing anything, but the fact that I made that instinctive move to do that, I had to realize I can't be doing this anymore. So the pandemic, yes, it took away any societal norms we have, but it started to take away my humanity as I noticed. I was not happy. I mean, I was literally just angry and scared all the time. I was scared for everybody. You know what? I'm in my 30s right now. Who knows how much time I got? Am I going to live my life here being in fear, being angry at the world, not having any compassion for people that live their freedoms? No, I can't live that way anymore. If I want to survive this pandemic and this is the way I'm going to go on living, it's not living. What's the point of it all then? This revelation did a lot for me. I was starting to actually be more forgiving and easing people who weren't practicing protocol. Because I thought that, you know what? We did this experiment before. They're not going to change. So why should I be enforcing the change on them if they don't want to? I have to worry about my own happiness. The pandemic surged on. I started to be more lenient with masking, as a lot of people did around 2022. I started to, okay, I'm only going to mask when I'm at work, when I'm at a doctor's office, or on public transit. Those are my rules. But you know what? If people don't want to obey those rules, that's their prerogative. It's too much effort to make people change. I'm done trying to change people. When I told my wife this news, that I feel like I should scale back a bit because I've kept us safe for this long, that I think we're all right, and I think we'll be okay. We're both vaccinated. We're both do the safe thing. I think we'll be okay. She was probably not as accepting of his news at first. She was still very scared, still very paranoid, still didn't know what was going to happen. But I told her, look, I can't live a life like this. We have to make some changes, all right? I'm sorry, but for us to survive and be happy during this pandemic, I need to make these changes. You don't have to do it right away. I'm just going to do it for myself. These past couple years, I've done everything to keep us safe, and we have not got it. Also, you're doing better. You're actually working from home again. You don't need my help with anything anymore. You're pretty independent. I think we'll both be okay. In 2022, at a friend's wedding, yes, we both caught COVID. Yes, it felt like a loss. But you know what? We actually survived, and we're both okay. We thank you, science. We thank you, vaccinations. I didn't beat myself up too much about that. I'm more to accept it and see that it just happened. Because it already happened to me around the world, and I figured, okay, I survived. We are fine. You know, so here we are. It's 2025, and the pandemic still rages on. It's not in the news anymore, of course. Who knows what's going to happen with RFK Jr. being the head of it all if we still have vaccinations. But you know what? Whatever's going to happen, I'm still going to be on the side of science. Now, when it comes to the woman, you know, the woman in the tan suit, the one who didn't mask up, who I got so angry at and followed her to her car. Am I still mad at her? Yeah. I still think it's wrong what she did. Of course, during that time, she'd been more considerate. But do I hate this woman? No, I don't hate her. She was living her life, doing what she had to do. It's not my business. She wasn't mask up. She still wasn't a mask up. Because I'm tired of being mad. So what I got from all of this is life is short. We have to live our lives. And we can't keep living it in fear and what's going to happen. Deal with it now, and the rest will happen later.
This is Risk. And we just heard from Joel Gonzalez. Joel is a writer who lives in San Francisco. He is currently a union organizer for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. God bless the people who are rebuilding our unions. So essential to getting back to the people power that we had the last time fascism was on the rise. You can find Joel's Substack at Joel Daniel Gonzalez, and you can find him on Instagram at the Joel Est. Folks, the next Risk Live show in New York is on March 17th. Tickets are at risk-show.com/live. And the next online storytelling workshop that I'm teaching starts on April 8th. You can email me at kevin@risk-show.com about that. And I mentioned also that we were looking for musicians to send us your music to play on Risk. This is something we did a lot more of in the early days, and we want to get back into it. So all you indie artists out there, send us your shit. We're looking for songs of all genres. And if you think your song would be especially great following a story about a certain topic, let us know that too. We're also looking for instrumental music, just like the Ekatl Arizmendi track we're hearing behind me now. And we're especially looking for music to score our radio stories, that ambient music, cinematic music, music that sets a specific mood, that sort of thing. So we'll give you a shout out on the podcast and credit you with links on the website. Everything you need to know about how to send us your music can be found at risk-show.com/music. One more thing, I am so excited to be telling my first story on stage in Bangkok at Bangkok Stories, curated by the wonderful John Englander. That'll be on February 28th at the Garage Burger and Grill. And just to be clear, the show is already sold out. So I'm not saying this so you'll come to see that particular show, but I am saying this to say, people of Bangkok, we need more storytelling shows. Do storytelling shows. Invite me to your storytelling shows. Ask me about how we could do Risk in Bangkok, as well as What's Your Story, our curated social events. Let's make 2026 the year that Bangkok becomes what to true storytelling New York City was in the mid-2000s, when this podcast was born. Email me at kevin@risk-show.com if you live in Bangkok and you're curious about storytelling and think there should be more of it here in Bangkok. Okay, that is it. And this episode was directed by Hope Brush and edited by Jeff Barr. Emma Yarbrough's story was coached by Michelle Walson and edited by Hope Brush. Joel Gonzalez's story was coached by David Crabb, edited by John LaSala, and sound designed by Hope Brush. Thanks to our business director, JC Cassis, our casting director, Cindy Freeman, and me. I am Kevin Allison. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.